On this week's 51%, we hear from a woman about how search engines reinforce racism.
It's not that we need Google to go away. We just need, you know, maybe 1,000 more differently motivated search engines too.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Searching.
Dr. Sophia Noble was studying library science when an academic colleague suggested she Google black girls. The top search results were images that perpetuated negative stereotypes, misogyny, and exploitation. That discovery was the beginning of an investigation that eventually became Noble's book, Algorithms of Oppression: How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller spoke with Noble at the University of Southern California, Annenberg School of Communication, where she's an assistant professor.
First, I did a very systematic study of a whole host of different identities. And I used the census categories as a way to kind of have a starting point for thinking about various kind of racial and ethnic categories. And then, you know, pairing those with boys, girls, men, and women. And so there were, you know, over 80 different combinations that I looked at. And people often ask me, of course, what happens when you search for white girls or white boys or white men? And I find that to be one of the interesting phenomena because, you know, usually you'll get something like either White Chicks, the movie by the Wayans brothers, which was very popular on a search for white girls for a long time. But you might get other things like objects, you know, white girls' dresses, which meaning, you know, girls' dresses that are the color white. So white becomes that kind of a descriptor. It's not an ethnic or a cultural descriptor. It's more of like kind of a color associated with various kinds of objects. So that's, I think, interesting. And part of that is because, as we know, in the United States, most white Americans don't think of themselves as white. They just think of themselves as Americans or as their own kind of specific identity. So that's, you know, something that I try to think through the complexities of that. But I was also interested in certain kinds of concepts. So, for example, if you did a search for a long time on the word beautiful, beautiful was synonymous in Google image search almost exclusively with images of white women. And again, you don't have to add the words women to the word beautiful, but conceptually, Google images framed beautiful as kind of thin women who fit the kind of standard beauty, contemporary beauty standard. So I looked in the book at kind of specific identities, but then I looked at other kinds of concepts. And one of the things that I always have found interesting is that for many years, I've talked about that specific example of beautiful and how I thought that something like nature would be represented as the concept of beauty, at least first in Google image search. And over the years, I've noticed that Google has actually changed its algorithm. And now when you do a search on beautiful, you often get nature. So I find that, you know, an interesting kind of quiet, silent relationship between Google and I, or its programmers mm-hmm. and some of its critics, right? Or the criticisms that are levied, not just by me. Of course, you know, people like Jesse Daniels, Siva Vaidyanathan, who wrote a great book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Jesse Daniels wrote a great book called Cyber Racism. I mean, they've talked about this phenomena, for example, for many years of doing a search on the word Jew and being led to Holocaust denial sites or anti-Semitic sites. And, you know, that's, I really trace even the kind of contemporary moments where that's happened, you know, on a variety of different searches that just get co-opted either by white supremacists or by large industries like the porn industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, the basic question in your book, I think, frames it up perfectly, which is to say, is it willful neglect? Or is it a profit imperative that is making money from racism and sexism? Like, who stands to benefit from having these images come up when the person searching is theoretically searching on what they think is just an amazing, well, as you said, new public library.
Right. I mean, one of the things I always try to stress to people is that Google search is not a kind of a public information portal akin to a library or a public library. It's really an advertising platform. And you can optimize a lot of content. Google's main interest is optimizing content for its advertisers, for its clients, for people who pay it to make their content visible. That's the entire premise of Google search. And so that we don't understand how profitable racism and sexism are is one of the reasons why I try to historicize some of these things and say, well, look, before we had the internet, racial stereotypes were really profitable in other places like Hollywood. Sexism has been really profitable. Sexually objectifying women is something that's been with us for a long time. And industries have made a lot of money off of that. And now those same practices are happening in an environment like the internet and in Google search, and not just Google. I mean, I could have really picked any big commercial search engine. It's just that Google is the monopoly leader and everyone else is trying to be like them. So it's important to study kind of who sets the tone for everyone else who's in the ecosystem. Google says that they optimize for over kind of 200 different features or qualities that they're concerned with. And I guess the question for me is, how is it that certain types of decisions and values are in play, like we don't want child sexual exploitation to surface, but we'll let blackface come through, or we'll let pornography come through, right? Or we'll let racist or discriminatory kinds of disinformation come through, but we make sure that like animal mutilation doesn't come through. Those are the kinds of questions that I think help us elucidate, you know, the complexity of these environments, and more importantly, what values are at play.
Yeah, well, I mean, what is the argument for that? That, you know, we live in a society that allows free speech, and, you know, to do anything different would be censorship, because sexism and racism, although there are laws against it, are not explicitly illegal like child sex exploitation is? I mean, what is the argument for not leaving those things out of the search results?
Well, this opens up a whole new area of conversation that I'm super interested in. So I'm glad that you asked this question. I mean, the first thing is all of the large tech platforms on the internet are deeply invested in this idea that they are not publishers. They are not responsible for the content that moves through their platforms. They are simply kind of a technical architecture through which people are speaking, and they are not responsible for the things that people speak or do on their platforms. Now, this is really important. It's an important distinction for these companies because, one, they're very invested in a kind of libertarian notions of anything goes on the internet and there's no censorship. And two, if they become responsible for the kind of content that flows through their platforms, well, now we're in trouble because they really don't have the capacity to moderate all of the content that does come through. And I think here about people like Professor Sarah Roberts at UCLA, who's done, you know, groundbreaking research on the people who look at the most horrific content and screen it out before it makes it, say, to YouTube or Facebook or into search. So there are kind of massive armies of people who are precarious, low-paid workers for the most part, dispersed globally, who have to look at some of this horrific content, and they do screen it out. And, you know, you could use the word censor, you could say screen, you could say moderate. But what's important here to know is that decision-making is happening all the time in these platforms, and content is coming out all the time in these platforms. And so from the gate, they are not free speech zones. And I think that's something that we need to understand. And we also need to understand that the companies are invested in us thinking that they're free speech zones, because otherwise they have to take greater responsibility for the kind of content. For example, they've got to be responsible when disinformation campaigns move through their platforms that maybe undermine democracy or foment ethnic cleansing or genocide around the world. I mean, many of these companies are not in a position to deal with the volume of content that's moving through their platforms. And so they stay anchored to this idea that it's an anything goes and they're not responsible. That's really the public that's responsible.
As I was reading your book and thinking about the way that search results come up and the information that we get when we're looking to learn something, and like the term that just keeps coming to my mind is that it's sort of like it's the canary in the coal mine. Like it feels like it's just the beginning of what can go wrong if AI is allowed to be incorporated too much into our lives.
I agree. I think that, you know, this book was difficult to write because I think there are you know, many of us who are studying these different platforms and the consequences of them for vulnerable people, for democracy, you know, kind of for the future of education and information, which are really important elements of a democracy, having people who are educated. I think there are other kind of unforeseen consequences. Like, what does it mean that we have come to believe that there is an answer? It can be found in 0.03 seconds, and you know, a search engine can provide it. You know, we have universities, we have schools. People go through a long process from kindergarten through 12th grade, and if they're fortunate to go to college, they have those experiences, because becoming educated and learning is a nuanced, iterative process, and it's part of the human experience. And search engines giving us an answer in 0.03 seconds really truncates our thinking about what it is to know, what it is to learn, what it is to kind of make sense of our world. And those are some of the things that I noticed just more anecdotally as a professor with my own students who will write their papers from a search engine and not from the library, and who often use, you know, misinformation sites or kind of propaganda, like they can't tell the difference sometimes. And that kind of critical thinking and ability to discern kind of, you know, raw information, misinformation from knowledge. I use Google all the time because for kind of banal information, like what's that actor? I can't remember. Okay, great. But, you know, when you start getting really comfortable with the banal, you will take it to the more sophisticated, and people do ask more sophisticated questions of search engines. And, you know, in the book, I wrote a whole chapter about Dylann Roof, for example, trying to make sense of the Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman case. And we know that ultimately, in his own words, that, you know, he went to a whole host of these kind of white supremacist sites and maybe not knowing. We don't really know if it, but on some level that information appealed to him. And ultimately he opened fire on 9 African Americans at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina. So it is important to think about, you know, not just the banal, but the more sophisticated and nuanced questions and the kinds of horrible information, quite frankly, that come back to answer those questions. I think over time, we're going to see that the stakes will be high for wanting those kinds of shortcuts and not taking the time to know better, to think differently, to appreciate science and philosophy, the arts, to just kind of lean on a crutch of a search engine for coming to understand our world. And that's really kind of the bigger project that I'm trying to communicate in this book.
Okay, and then there's just this little thing called the election of 2016. But before we even go there, you have something in your book that was about a study from 2013 about manipulating search rankings and how that could shift voter preferences without them even being aware.
Yes. So this is a really important study by Epstein and Robertson. They did a controlled study where they had voters do searches. And if on the first page they were exposed to content that was negative about a candidate, they said they would not vote for them. And if it was positive about a candidate, they said they would vote for them. And they argued ultimately from the findings of their study that democracy was really at risk because search engine rankings are so easily manipulable that people don't even know if they are being manipulated. And I thought this was a really important study, and I talk about it a lot, and I try to share these scholars' work with others, because the truth is, there was an incredible amount of media manipulation happening during the 2016 presidential election. And, you know, we know this, and I think a lot of the focus has been on Facebook and to some degree Twitter, and the way in which misinformation or disinformation around Hillary Clinton, for example, circulated. But, you know, what people paid a lot less attention to were the ways, I think, that Google and its properties like YouTube were also being used. And one of the things that's particularly interesting to me is how people often use Google to fact check. So let's say they see something that doesn't make a lot of sense, or they're not sure. They're like, there was like a sinister conspiracy running out of a pizza shop, right? Let's go check that out. Well, they're most likely to go to Google to fact check that, right? Thinking that Google will be the place to do the sense making of things they find in social media. So I think that's a really important thing we need to keep in mind, again, about how the public relates to what they find. We know, for example, from the Pew Internet research studies that people believe more than 70% of the public believes that uses search engines believes that what they find there is accurate and trustworthy, right? That it's credible or reliable. And, you know, immediately following the 2016 election, the news was widely covering the story that if you did a search on final U.S. presidential election results, you were led. The very first site was a disinformation site that said that Donald Trump had won the popular vote. Now, you know, this isn't just an alternative fact. This is a flat out lie. And yet here we have half the country who to this day still believes that Donald Trump won the popular vote. And I think that these kinds of things, when we talk about the veracity of information, how can we trust information? How does information play a role in democracy and politics? Even just trying to make sense of the political environment is very, very difficult when people are deeply reliant upon a search engine and, by extension, social media.
Well, you offer, I'm going to ask you to describe this visualization that you're offering up as an alternative way of viewing search results. Is that an impossible request?
No,
I thought
it's
really cool, okay. And I think you should talk about it.
Okay. So, you know, people often say, oh, Safiya, you know, everything you're talking about is a downer. And I admittedly, oppression is a downer.
As I cackle wildly. Anyway, yes.
I mean, you know, it's like we're laughing as a defense mechanism.
That's
I understand
right.
it. Okay. So, you know, both of my parents were artists. And so the metaphors that I draw on, you know, in my own life are often from the art world. And so one of the things that I said is, you know, and I kind of argue for as it's really not fair to call this a solution, because I don't really think it's a solutionist kind of approach to the complexities of the things we're talking about. Like, there isn't just an answer, and if we did that, or a different technical system, and then if we did that, it would be fine. But I do think that, you know, like if we had a really diverse media scape, so to speak, and we had multiple ways of thinking about finding information on the internet, that would be better than having one or two. So I use the metaphor of the color picker tool, which many of us know is kind of that color wheel where all the colors kind of blend into each other. And we're trying to, you know, we use this often kind of, you know, on the internet when we're looking for like a pretty color for our fonts or our objects. And, you know, I use this metaphor to say, well, what if our interface to information on the internet was accessed through something that looked more like a color picker tool, where if I put my search box on the red portion of the color picker tool of the color wheel, I kind of know that's the red light district, so to speak, of the web. And I know what's kind of coming there. And maybe if I drag it to blue, it's the government information or it's academic studies or it's research. And maybe if I drag my search box to the green part, I know that's going to be products or things for sale, right? Or kind of a more commercial environment. And maybe we could nuance this so that we could make sense of things that are kind of overlapping and meeting multiple interests. What I'm trying to do with the metaphor in the book is describe, like, what would it mean if we had something other than a ranking system from one to a million or more as a way to make sense of the information we find online. And part of that's because we're in a cultural context, certainly in the US and in the West, where to be number one is to be the best. So if you go to a page and you're experiencing information in a rank order fashion, there's already a cultural context for number one being the best. You know, we don't have a foamy finger at the football game that says 1,000,300, and, you know, I mean, we're not doing that. We're doing number one. And so number one is something we might want to disrupt right out of the gate. The other thing I say that's really important to this is we need a non-commercial way of accessing information. And this is where I'm so grateful to librarians in particular who have been curating and sense-making and organizing knowledge for thousands and thousands of years for us. And we, whether it's oral forms of knowledge or print knowledge, they have done the work of kind of helping organize and not necessarily for a profit motive in the same way that an advertising platform like a commercial search engine is doing. And so I've been trying to raise money. And if there are any foundations or funders who are interested in supporting librarians, academic and public librarians in tackling, you know, some of the indexing of the open web, I think that would be really viable and valuable to our democracy. We need just many, many ways of cutting in rather than having a handful of platforms kind of serve as the gatekeepers. And to me, that is, it's not that we need Google to go away. We just need, you know, maybe 1,000 more differently motivated search engines too.
That was Dr. Sophia Noble, author of Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. She was speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. You can hear the full conversation and Schiller's other conversations at inflectionpointradio.org and on her Inflection Point podcast. A new report says more women in the poorest countries are using modern contraception, signifying progress in efforts to involve women in family planning. But the report that was launched in mid-November by the UN-backed advocacy group FP 2020 says many others who want to delay or prevent pregnancy are unable to access contraception, often due to lack of information. The report says access to modern contraception helped prevent more than 119 million unintended pregnancies from July 2017 to July 2018. Beth Schlachter, executive director of FP 2020, told the Associated Press that for poor families to feed themselves and recover from poverty, women and girls must be able to decide how many children they want to have. The report says contraceptive use is growing fastest in Africa, even though the region's fertility rates remain high. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Arrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1531.